Chapter 27. The shaky images on the video screen jumped spastically, making it obvious that they had been shot with a handheld camera under unsteady circumstances. The camera showed three men seen from behind. They were wearing bandanas wrapped around their heads, and automatic weapons were slung over their shoulders. The men were in a moving, inflatable boat, and the scene rose and dipped with the waves as the boat approached a rusty freighter of medium size. A hard-edged voice could be heard over the buzz of the outboard motor. "Approaching target. Heads up, boys, this isn't a joyride. We'll try a false insertion to see if we can draw fire." The man closest to the lens turned and gave a thumbs up. Then the picture froze. Ensign Muller rose from his chair and stood beside the flat wall screen. He pointed to the dark-skinned man grinning into the camera lens. "That's Sal Russo," he said to Austin and the others seated in the room. "Top-notch. Savvy and tough as nails. Helped form SEAL Team 6, the anti-terrorism unit. Picked up a basketful of medals for his Persian Gulf service before mustering out to join Beck's company." "And that must be Captain Beck's voice in the background," Austin said. He was seated in a folding chair next to Zavala and Gutierrez. "That's right. Beck had a video camera on a chest harness. He used it as a training tool to show his teams where they made mistakes and what they did right. He was still wearing the camera when we plucked his body out of the water. Fortunately, it was in a waterproof housing. The picture gets a little jumpy from time to time, but it will give you a pretty good idea of what they encountered." Muller punched the resume button on the remote control and returned to his chair. The man on the screen came back to life and turned with his back to the camera again. The buzz of the outboard ratcheted up several decibels. The bow lifted as the boat rose on plane and headed directly toward the boarding ladder that hung down the starboard bow. 100 feet from the ladder, the boat veered off and sped away from the freighter. "Attempt to draw fire was unsuccessful," the voice said. "Let's check out the name on the stern." The camera showed the boat coming around behind the ship, where the words Celtic Rainbow and below that Malta were visible on the peeling hull. Then the boat moved alongside the larger vessel and headed back to the ladder. As they came up to the side, a man grabbed a rung and held the boat in place. Everyone put gas masks on, and two SEALs clambered up the ladder. The bowman pushed the boat off a few yards and brought his gun to bear on the deck, ready to pick off anyone trying to ambush the boarders. The two men climbed to the deck without incident. The point man waved the boat back in. "Slick insertion with no resistance," Beck said. "Backup going in now." With the boat tied up to the ladder, Beck and Russo began to climb. There was a jumpy picture of the side of the ship, and the microphone picked up the sound of heavy breathing. Beck's voice could be heard muttering, "Getting too old for this crap. Hell of a lot more fun than sitting at a desk, though." The camera panned the deck to show the SEALs crouched low, weapons at ready. Smoke drifted over the deck from the billowing cloud. As set out in their pre-plan, Russo took one man and made a heads-down dash to the other side of the ship, and then they worked their way toward the stern. Beck and the other SEAL did the same on the starboard deck, and the team rendezvoused at the stern rail. "Port side's clear," Russo said. He squinted at the smoke. "Looks like the fire's going out." "You're right," Beck said. "Smoke is thinning. Remove your masks." The men did as ordered, tucking their masks into belt bags. "Okay, let's check the bridge to see who's sending that message." The camera showed the men moving in leapfrog fashion, first one team, then the others, so that the lead team was always covered. They climbed the companionways, pausing at each deck before going on, reaching the bridge wings with no incident. The voice of someone calling Mayday was coming through the open door of the wheelhouse. Speed, surprise, and stealth are the essences of a SEAL mission. Having to board the ship in broad daylight ruled out two of those elements, so they wasted no time outside the wheelhouse. The camera followed them in, and Beck's voice could be heard saying, "Good job." "Hell, damn place is empty." The camera showed a 360-degree sweep of the wheelhouse, and then Beck went over to the ship's radio. A hand, obviously his, reached out and picked up a tape recorder next to the radio's microphone. The Mayday message they had heard was repeating over and over. The hand clicked off the recorder, and the Maydays stopped. God damn it, one of the men said. What the hell's that stink? Beck's voice could be heard in the background, calm but with an unmistakable sense of urgency, ordering his men to cock their weapons, stay sharp, and make their way double time back to their boat. Then the gates of Hades opened. Someone or something launched itself through the door, shrieking like an angry banshee. Then came the thundering blast of a shotgun at close range. More shrieks and lunging bodies and the rattle of automatic weapons fire. There were blurred flashes of dingy white hair or fur and glimpses of faces out of a nightmare. This way, Captain! Chip Russo had his back to the camera, blocking out most of the picture. More gunfire and hideous screams, then a whole series of blurred images. Beck was out of the wheelhouse and appeared to be half falling, half climbing down the companionways. His breath was coming out in great, hoarse gasps. Russo could be heard in the background yelling, "Move it, Cap, move! I nailed one of the red-eyed sons of bitches, but they're on our asses! My men! Too late! Move!" Oh, hell. Another blast of gunfire. Then a man screaming. Beck had made it to the main deck. He was running now, huffing like a locomotive climbing a steep hill, his boots pounding. He was near the bow within a few feet of the ladder. There was an inhuman scream from off camera. More white hair and lunging bodies, then another shotgun blast. A glimpse of luminous red eyes, then a gurgle and whirling sky and sea. The screen went dark. Austin broke the stunned silence that followed. Your video raises more questions than it answers. Beck almost made it back to the boat, Muller said, but someone or something ambushed him as he was about to climb down the ladder. When his body was found, his throat had been torn open. Could you go back a few seconds in the video? Zavala said. Muller complied. Okay, freeze it right there. The burning red eyes almost filled the screen. The image was fuzzy, but the vagueness didn't diminish the feral intensity. A silence ensued in the room, broken only by the hum of the ship's ventilator. Finally, Austin said, "What do you make of this video, Ensign?" Muller shook his head like a man who'd been asked to explain the mysteries of the universe. "The only thing I'm sure of is that Captain Beck and his men got themselves into a hell of a mess. Whoever or whatever ambushed them didn't expect to run into an armed SEAL unit. My guess is that they intended to attack the Atlantis, but changed their minds after the fight with Beck and his men," Austin said. "That was my take on it, too," Muller said. Captain Gutierrez rose from his chair. "I've got to get back to the bridge. You gentlemen let me know if there's anything further I can do to help." Austin thanked Gutierrez and, after he left, turned to Muller. "I suppose you'll be going back to your ship." "Not quite yet. A relief vessel is coming in to stand guard duty. Should be here in a few hours. I've got time." "Now that the captain is gone, I'd like to talk about this situation, if you don't mind." "Not at all," Austin said. "From the little I've seen, there's a lot to talk about." Muller smiled. "When I first heard this crazy story, I thought we might be dealing with pirates, although there was no evidence that they were operating in this part of the world." "You've changed your mind about the pirates?" Austin said. "I've discarded that theory. I neglected to mention that I'm an intelligence officer with the Navy. After I saw the video, I contacted my staff in Washington and asked them to research everything they could on red-eyed monsters or fiends. You should have heard the disrespectful replies I got, but they went through every source they could. From Dracula, photography, Hollywood movies. Did you know there's a rock group called Red-Eyed Demons?" "My rock education stopped with the Rolling Stones," Austin said. "Me too. Anyhow, I spent some time going over their reports and kept coming back to this." Muller took a sheet of paper from his briefcase and handed it to Austin, who unfolded it and read the headline. "TV cast, crew still missing. Police baffled." It was a Reuters news story datelined London. He kept reading. "Authorities say they still have no leads in the disappearance of 7 participants and 4 technical crew members who were filming an episode of The Outcasts television show on a remote island off the coast of Scotland. Under the rules of the game, the other members of the so-called clan vote an outcast off the island each week. A helicopter sent to pick up the latest exile found no sign of the others. Police, working with the FBI, found traces of blood, suggesting the possibility of violence. The lone survivor who was found hiding is recuperating at home. She is said to have been quoted as saying the survivors were attacked by red-eyed fiends. Authorities have discounted this account, saying that the victim was suffering from hallucinations brought on by shock. The popular TV show, a spin-off of earlier Survivor-type productions, has been criticized by some for encouraging even greater tension among participants and subjecting them to risky tests involving mental and physical stress. The network has offered a $50,000 reward for information. Kurt handed the article to Zavala, who read the story and said, "How does this tie in with the Alvin's disappearance?" "It's a tenuous connection, I'll admit, but try to follow my convoluted line of thinking. I went back to those undersea tracks. It was clear that something was going on in the Lost City, and someone wanted the activity kept a secret." "That sounds right," Zavala said. "Whoever made those tracks wouldn't want anyone nosing around the thermal vents." "If you had a secret like that, what would you do if a submersible loaded with cameras dropped into your backyard?" "Simple," Zavala said. "The expedition was publicized, so I'd move my equipment out." Austin said, "Not so simple. Someone was bound to see the tracks and ask questions. You'd have to eliminate the outside observers. And you'd have to take care of any witnesses." "Then that would explain why a shipload of red-eyed freaks was unleashed on the Atlantis," Zavala said. Austin said, "Suppose the Atlantis vanished. A while later, the Alvin surfaced, and when it sees the support ship has disappeared, it calls for help. A massive search would be launched. There's always the chance that a search would pick up traces of the Alvin and attract more attention." "Which means whatever made those tracks may have snatched the Alvin," Zavala said. "Gutierrez says the submersible isn't down there, and I believe him," Mahler said. Austin glanced at the news article again. "Red eyes here, red eyes there. As you say, a tenuous connection." "I agree. That's why I ordered up a series of satellite photos of the waters surrounding the outcast's island." From his briefcase, he took a stack of photos and spread them out on a table. "Most of the islands have small fishing villages that have been there for years. On others, the only inhabitants are birds. This one was unusual enough to catch my attention." He slid a picture toward Austin. The photo showed several buildings, most of them clustered away from the shore, and some primitive roads. "Any idea what these structures are?" Austin said. "That island was originally owned by the British government, which operated it as a submarine station during World War II and the Cold War. Later, it was sold to a private corporation. We're still looking into that. Supposedly, it was used for bird research, although nobody knows for sure because access to the island is barred." "This could be a patrol boat to enforce the no trespassing order," Austin said, pointing to a tiny white line that marked a wake. "That's a good bet," Mueller agreed. "I had the pictures taken at different times during the day, and the boat is always at some point around the island, following pretty much the same route." As he examined the rocks and shoals guarding the island, Austin noticed a dark oval object near the harbor opening. He saw it again in other photos, but at different positions. It had a vague outline, as if it were underwater rather than on the surface. He turned the photos over to Zavala. "Take a look at these and see if you see anything unusual, Joe." As the team's expert on remotely operated and manned undersea vehicles, Zavala noticed the strange object immediately. He spread out the pictures. "This looks like an underwater vehicle of some sort." "Let me see that," Mueller said. "I'll be damned. I was so concentrated on what was above water that I didn't notice what was under it. I must have thought it was a fish of some kind." "It's a fish, all right," Zavala said. "Battery operated and motorized. My guess is that it's an AUV. An autonomous underwater vehicle." Originally built for commercial and research use, AUVs were the hottest development in undersea technology. The robot vehicles could operate on their own, guided by pre-programmed instructions, unlike remote-operated vehicles that had to be guided with a tether. This AUV could have a sonar and acoustic instrumentation, and would be able to detect anything or anyone moving on or under the waters surrounding the island. It could send an alarm to land-based monitors. The Navy has been using AUVs as replacements for the dolphins who sniffed out mines. I've heard that some AUVs can be programmed to attack, Mahler said. Austin stared at the photos and said, "It seems that we may have to make a fast decision." "Look, I'm not telling you what that should be, and I know you're concerned about your friends," Mahler said. "But there isn't much you can do here. Captain Gutierrez will continue the search, and he can notify you if and when he finds something." "You'd like us to check this place out?" "The U.S. Navy can't go busting in on this island, but a couple of highly trained and determined people could." Austin turned to Zavala. "What do you think we should do, Joe?" "It's a gamble," Zavala said. "While we're chasing creeps with bloodshot eyes, Paul and Gamay could be a million other places." Austin knew that Zavala was right, but his instincts were pointing him to the island. "We asked the seaplane to stand by," he told Ensign Muller. "We'll fly back to the Azores and catch a jet. With any luck, we can take a close look at your mysterious island tomorrow."
"I hoped you'd say that," Muller said with a smile.
Less than an hour later, the seaplane lifted off from the water and climbed into the air. The aircraft circled once over the research vessel and the cruiser, and then headed toward the Azores, taking Austin and Zavala on the first leg of their journey into the unknown.